The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have acquired the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect brings you a full hour of news review. First, old news to Hamiltonians, but U.S. Steel Union relents on key contract demands. The pension crisis that helped send Stelco Incorporated into creditor protection 7 years ago is looming on the horizon again. In the face of that threat, Local 1005 of the United Steelworkers has given in on two key demands, reaching a settlement with United States Steel Corp, the company that took over Stelco. Local 1005 has agreed to give up its demands that U.S. Steel continue indexing of pension benefits for retirees and to permit the creation of a defined contribution pension plan for newly hired employees. Employers in all sections are converting defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans for closing off the richer defined benefit plans to newly hired employees. Indexing of pension plans is all but unheard of in the private sector. Local 1005 softened the blow for 9,000 retirees in Hamilton by negotiating a $1,000 lump sum payment to retirees now receiving less than $1,500 a month. That covers about 4,200 pensioners. U.S. Steel also agreed to a new profit-sharing formula that will pay out 6.5% of earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization in excess of $25 million to a maximum of $3,500 per active employee. With the takeover, U.S. Steel inherited Stelco's promise to make $70 million annual payments to the pension funds to return them to solvency. That story by Greg Keenan, steel industry reporter for the Globe and Mail. 1,005 votes yes, but nobody liked it. Callbacks already begun. Work may start up as early as Tuesday. At the end, Norm McAvoy was alone on the U.S. steel picket line, gathering up union and Canadian flags at the end of the longest labor management confrontation in Hamilton steel history. On Saturday, barely an hour after union leaders announced members had voted 61% in favor of accepting a settlement few liked, there was a phone call to the picket line captain saying simply, "That's it, go home." There were no politicians vowing to stand in solidarity with the workers against a foreign predator, no television cameras recording the event, just a lone worker gathering flags so they wouldn't fall into the hands of management. Like so many workers of United Steelworkers Local 1005, McAvoy's feelings at the end of the bitter confrontation were mixed. He dislikes the settlement members accepted, but agrees it was time for this round of the confrontation to end. It had to be done. Nobody liked it, but the alternative was another winter on the line, he said. Yes, somebody's going to be put out, but that was going to happen. One way or another, somebody was going to lose. For 11 months, McAvoy and his co-workers patrolled their picket line to defend pension indexing for current retirees and a defined benefit plan for new employees of U.S. Steel. That by Steve Arnold in the Hamilton Spectator. U.S. Steel must keep promises as judge denies appeal. U.S. Steel has suffered another defeat in its ongoing legal dispute with the federal government. In a decision released, the Federal Court of Appeal has swept aside a company effort to overturn a verdict changing the way it is to meet jobs and production promises it made to get federal approval to buy Stelco. The original promises expired October 31, 2010. but the court changed the timing, so they must be met for 3 years after the federal suit is decided. This affirms that change and clears the way for a hearing on the main case yet to be scheduled. For the past 2 years, the company and federal attorney general have been locked in a lawsuit over allegations the company broke promises to employ an average 3,105 workers for 3 years and to produce more than 13 million tons of steel over that period. Within a year of buying Stelco, however, U.S. Steel began laying off staff and shutting down facilities in Canada. The government is asking for fines of $10,000 a day for every day the company fails to meet those commitments. And again, that by Steve Arnold in the Hamilton Spectator. Bridging the gap. Hamilton would be a better place for everyone if incomes were more equal. What would Hamilton be like if we were all the same? Probably a lot less interesting, for starters. But let's change the question slightly. What would Hamilton be like if we were all equal? Turns out there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the city would be a better place for everyone, and not just those who have been pushed to the margins of society. Hundreds of studies now provide powerful support for the notion that the greater the income inequality across a group of people, the worse the outcomes are for everyone, for any number of health and social factors. The bad news: data collected by the Hamilton Community Foundation as part of its annual Vital Signs report card shows that the gap between the rich and the poor in Hamilton has shown no improvement over the past decade, and in fact, the gap might even be growing. There are now almost as many households in Hamilton earning $100,000 a year as there are with annual incomes of less than $20,000. Use another measure of income distribution and the picture is no better. In 2009, the poorest 20% of Hamiltonians earned a combined total of just 5% of the city's total income. Meanwhile, the richest 20% earned a combined total of 41% of total income, a gap between the bottom and the top that has remained unchanged for nearly a decade. More people are making $100,000 than ever before, but we also know that more Hamiltonians are using food banks and are on social housing waitlists than ever before, said Tom Cooper, director of the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. We need to ensure that Hamilton's most vulnerable have opportunities to move forward. Right now, too many are being left behind. Many of those being left behind are children. From 2006 to 2009, the rate of children living in poverty actually climbed slightly from 25 to 26%, an appalling rate in either case. Using data from what are known as forward sortation areas, the first three characters of the postal code, the Hamilton Community Foundation's numbers show that only one of the 22 forward sortation areas in Hamilton has a rate of child poverty below 10%. On the other hand, the three forward sortation areas that cover most of the lower inner city all have rates of child poverty greater than 50%. And if that's not enough, Hamilton's Ontario Works caseload grew by a whopping 40% from 2008 to June of this year and is now over 14,000 cases. What we've learned is that there's both a human and a fiscal cost associated with income inequality that impacts everybody in a metropolitan area, said Terry Cook, president and CEO of the Hamilton Community Foundation. The problem spreads over time and it undermines economic performance and the cost of responding for everybody, Cook added. The connections between poverty and poor health in Hamilton were laid out starkly last year in the Spectator's groundbreaking Code Red series, which showed there were staggering discrepancies in health outcomes and life expectancy across the city. The series showed that some neighborhoods in Hamilton are living with third world health outcomes. This is a matter of the rich and the rest of us, said Jim Dunn, a McMaster University professor who specializes in research involving urban neighborhoods and community health. The very rich are getting richer, and everyone else has incomes that are flat or declining. This has been happening for the last 25 years or so, driven by the persistent drive to cut taxes, Dunn noted. This mainly benefits the rich and not the rest of us. To help fund those cuts, the rest of us get reduced services and benefits. For example, declining levels for social assistance and disability pensions, tighter restrictions on unemployment insurance, and higher user fees at the same time that incomes are flat or declining. The question, said Dr. Chris Mackey, the city's associate medical officer of health, is whether or not Hamilton sees itself as a caring community. Or are we just a bunch of individuals out there fighting for ourselves, he added, and that's all we should be doing, and just allow those people who have more to protect what they already have, and make sure the people with less don't get any of it. And that by Steve Buist in the Hamilton Spectator. Poverty advocates treated poorly. Advocates for social assistance rates high enough to provide nutritious food got a rude reception at the Board of Health. They waited 2.5 hours to speak and then watched as more than half the councillors walked out, leaving the delegates to address a board that was far short of a quorum. Staff recommendations supported by the citizen delegates were eventually approved unanimously without debate once quorum was restored, despite being nearly identical to resolutions presented in July by citizens that five councillors and the mayor strenuously opposed. The latter proposals were put forward by the Hamilton Community Legal Clinic, backed up by a report from McMaster Economics Professor Atif Kubursi, while last week's came from Health Department staff. Staff have proposed a pilot program to give a $20 gift certificate for a farmer's market to these individuals, but acknowledge this is far from adequate. For those who must follow a strict budget, the choice is not between a generic and name brand product, states their heavily documented report. It means the choice between food and hunger. Lack of nutritious food has a huge impact on health. Individuals in food-insufficient households are more likely to report poor general health, major depression and distress, and multiple chronic conditions, including heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, and food allergies. That was also the message from Elizabeth McGuire of the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits in her presentation. What the Minister of Social Services may be saving today in social assistance payments, the Ministry of Health will be bearing those costs over the long term. That story by Don McLean in View magazine in the Catch update for citizens at City Hall. Food bank donations up, demand down, says Salvation Army. Glimmer of hope seen in charity survey. A report from the Salvation Army offered a glimmer of hope with the news that food donations in Canada went up and food bank usage didn't increase as much as the previous year. The charity's third annual survey, completed in September, of 160 workers and administrators at Salvation Army food service programs across Canada, found that 32% reported an increase in food donations in 2011 compared to 18% the previous year. About 26% reported a decrease in donations in 2011. About 26% reported a decrease in donations in 2011 compared to 33% in 2010. About 64% of those surveyed reported that their food shelves were half full to full, an improvement from 55% in 2010. The report noted that while 73% of the food service workers report an increase in 2011 in demand for services, which include food banks, street outreach, and shelter meals, that's down from 81% who reported an increase in demand the previous year. The increase in food donations is always good news, said Andrew Burdett, National Director of Marketing and Communications for the Salvation Army. I think we can be heartened by the fact that Canadians have responded. Canadians are inherently charitable. 4 or 5 years ago, the typical Salvation Army food client may have been a homeless man aged 30 to 40, said Burdett. Nowadays, it might be an IT computer professional who just lost his job, he said. Burdett said the numbers for volunteer involvement are heartening, noting that about 85% of those surveyed reported that volunteer rates at food programs have either increased or remained the same as the previous year. And that in The Star by Valerie Houch, staff reporter. Now take a short break with me, Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, Wild Turkey, 101 Proof.
This say that time waits for no one. Time goes by when you're having fun. But when the room starts spinning around, then it's time to put that whiskey down. Wild Turkey 101 proof, you'd be higher than the roof. If you live your life on the edge, raise your hands and repeat this pledge. I promise not to overdrink, 'cause I'll be drunker than I think. I won't be a fool to cross the line. I mix my drink with a glass of wine. If you think that you are Superman and ignore this thought out plan, you'll wake up drunk in your sack with that whiskey bird on your back. Wild Turkey 101 proof, you'll be higher than the roof. If you live your life on the edge, raise your hands and repeat this pledge. A glass of wine, have that drink, but not too much. Take my warning as a finishing touch. If you drink that whiskey too fast, I guarantee that you won't last. Wild Turkey 101 proof, Wild Turkey 101 proof. If you try to chase that big wild bird, then you've ignored everything you've heard. Wild Turkey 101 proof, Wild Turkey 101 proof, Wild Turkey 101 proof. You'd be higher than your roof.
How bold can McGinty afford to be? Four files that will test the Liberal minority's tolerance for risk. Despite falling one seat short in the Ontario election, Dalton McGuinty's Liberals have been talking a big game about governing as though they have another majority government. The next 6 months will offer several tests of just how bold they're prepared to be. First, dueling with doctors. Officials have long looked forward to the 2012 expiration of the Ontario Medical Association's contract with a mix of anticipation and dread. It's a big opportunity to make progress on flattening annual increases in health spending, but it could make last year's successful fight with pharmacies over drug prices look like a walk in the park. Mr. McGuinty reiterated during the election campaign that he wants doctors to accept a pay freeze for the next 2 years, something the government has struggled to impose on other professions. The Liberals will also likely be looking, as in past negotiations, to get more doctors onto salaries and off fee for service. To the future of LHINs. As if fighting with doctors isn't enough on the healthcare front, the government also has to determine the future of local health integration networks. Both opposition parties promised during the campaign to get rid of LHINs. The Liberals not only want to keep them, they want to make them stronger. They want to shift some decision-making control from hospital boards to centrally appointed executives, and that's not an easy sell in many communities. 3. The energy cleanup. If Mr. McGuinty really wants to govern like he has a majority, he'll follow the time-honored tradition of dumping a bunch of bad news in the first couple of months after the election. And if so, most of it will come in the energy sector. At some point, they'll need to announce the considerable cost of canceling the construction of not one but two gas-fired power plants in Oakville and Mississauga. They will also likely need to sort out the green energy contracts signed in haste before the campaign, some of which contain targets that will be very hard to meet. And they'll need to make changes to the pricing of both wind and solar power after the mandatory review of the province's feed-in tariff program is released. None of these things are going away. If Ontarians don't hear many of the details before the end of the year, it will mean the Liberals are stalling. And 4, the budget. Some Liberals will be wary of making their next budget too provocative, since it will be the first big opportunity for the opposition parties to bring them down. But others contend that neither the NDP nor Progressive Conservatives will be looking to force another election within a few months of the last one, and that the latter in particular would be hard-pressed to campaign against belt-tightening. Former bank economist Don Drummond, commissioned pre-election to review the province's public services, is unlikely to pull any punches in his recommendations for how to do things more efficiently. His report could form much of the basis for the budget. If the Liberals instead try to sweep it under the carpet, it won't say much for their self-confidence. And that by Adam Radwanski in the Globe and Mail. Time for a rethink of modern economics. Canadian economists Dan Kuryak and John Curtis argue in a provocative new study that maybe we have everything all wrong about how the global economy works. Flexible labor markets, massive unrestrained capital flows, floating exchange rates, and tax breaks for investors and businesses to drive production of goods and services were supposed to bring prosperity. But 3 decades of these supply-side policies have produced the same economic problems they were supposed to fix, including stagnant growth, high unemployment, deflationary pressures, and piles of public sector debt, according to Mr. Curtis, a fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, Ontario, and Mr. Kuryak, former Deputy Chief Economist at the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. There's an inherent contradiction in the model. These policies are causing household incomes to fall, making consumers less able to buy things. The recent sharp plunge in the prices of oil, wheat, copper, and other vital commodities suggest that's exactly what's happening. Second-guessing supply-side economics is more than an academic exercise. Some of the prescriptions now on the table to get the world out of this mess may actually be hastening another recession. Median U.S. household incomes are falling. Nearly half of the 14 million jobless Americans have been out of work for more than 6 months. And economists are predicting years of high unemployment. This is unheard of. This has never happened in post-war period in the United States, said Ben Bernanke during a question-and-answer session following a speech in Cleveland last week. A similar debate is raging in Europe, where wealthy countries are demanding budget-slashing measures as a precondition for continuing to bail out poorer neighbors, even though doing so will cause many Eurozone economies to shrink, making it harder for them to pay down debt. Accepted beliefs can and do change. Today's orthodoxy can become tomorrow's heresy. It's certainly worth asking the right questions so we avoid repeating the same mistakes. And that story by Barry McKenna in the Globe and Mail. Cities on high alert, an age of urban unrest. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg rang alarm bells when he said that high unemployment could lead to mass social unrest in cities across the United States. You have a lot of kids graduating college who can't find jobs. That's what happened in Cairo, that's what happened in Madrid. You don't want those kinds of riots here, Bloomberg explained in a radio address last month. The mayor was not alone in this assessment. Former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn said as much back in 2008. Unemployment, he declared, represents a risk to the stability of existing democracies. Since the onset of the global economic crisis in 2007-2008, cities have seen rising levels of violence and social unrest, riots and looting in the UK, intensified gang violence in major US cities, street clashes in Athens, flash robs in Philadelphia, mass protests in Madrid, ghetto dwellers and security forces facing off in Kingston, Jamaica, rival drug cartels engaged in shootouts in Juarez, Mexico. The list goes on. As many political observers have remarked, a driving force behind the Arab Spring, apart from an unquenched thirst for democracy, is unemployment, and particularly extremely high levels of youth unemployment. Non-governmental organizations have started making the connections as well. A recent report from the International Red Cross entitled Urban Violence, War by Any Other Name, observes, around the world, cities are experiencing an alarming increase in violence and its resulting misery. Chronic conflict makes daily life in some places almost like living in a war zone. And images of urban unrest not only flash nightly across our TV screens and occupy the pages of our newspapers, they also permeate our popular culture as never before. Just watch recent science fiction films like Attack the Block, District 9, and Battle, Los Angeles. The city as a place of conflict and civil disorder is part of our culture. We have then, it appears, entered an age of urban unrest. But London's not Philadelphia, and Cairo not Kingston. From riots and looting to mass protest, flash robs, and gang warfare, there are very different types of urban violence and social unrest with seemingly disparate causes. But while poverty, inequality, and unemployment do not tell a full story in all places, they do tell much of the story in many places. In the case of the UK's recent disorder, we've learned from The Guardian that the vast majority of rioters brought before the courts are young, poor, and unemployed. In the Tottenham neighborhood where the riots began, 54 people chase every one available job. Empirical data on close to 40 European and Latin American countries demonstrates a positive statistical association between government spending cuts, unemployment, and levels of unrest, including anti-government demonstrations, riots, strikes, and attempted revolutions. In addition, path-breaking research by social epidemiologists has found that among advanced democracies, more equal societies, and by extension cities, are also more socially stable and less violent. When channeled into movements seeking to address legitimate grievances, as in the Arab Spring, urban unrest, disruption, and disorder can be welcomed. Yet few urban denizens welcome the type of violence and disruption that causes misery, damage, and distress in their lives and in the life of their city. We live in an urban age. In 1950, less than 30% of the world's population were city dwellers. Now, for the first time in human history, the world's urban population outnumbers its rural. And whether we live in Toronto or Tokyo, Lagos or Los Angeles, safety and security are necessary conditions for a flourishing urbanity and a decent quality of life. As even the conservative-leaning mayor of New York City has realized, addressing inequality, deprivation, and unemployment with meaningful government action is central to maintaining social cohesion in an era of economic uncertainty. And that by frequent guest to the show, Simon Black, a researcher in the area of urban social policy at the City Institute at York University. Protest peaceful in Toronto Financial District. Protesters took over intersections in Toronto's Financial District and its busiest shopping area on Monday afternoon, tying up rush hour traffic and drawing crowds of curious onlookers as they snaked through the center of the city. Police shadowed the march on bicycles but made no attempt to interfere. Protesters first occupied King and Bay Streets outside the headquarters of most of the nation's banks. Next, they marched to north north to Yonge and Dundas Streets, creating a 99% formation to echo the movement's contention that 1% of the world controls most of its wealth. The protests shut down the Dundas streetcar line before heading east and returning to St. James Park at Jarvis Street. About 200 people, nearly all of them youths and young adults, took part in that demonstration. While a handful identified with particular groups, including a contingent of First Nations activists, union banners and other visible displays of affiliation were largely absent. This freewheeling form of organizing has been a hallmark of the protests. The entire crowd takes part in decision-making, and much of the march was spent in enormous group discussions on what to do next. That by Adrian Morrow in the Globe and Mail. Many protesters say they're here to stay. Many Occupy Toronto protesters have no plans to leave the tent city they put up in St. James Park anytime soon. Said Peter, a drummer in a band, "My personal message is anarchy and love, because I truly believe as long as we aren't hurting anyone or causing harm or loss to another person, we should be free to do as we please." While those in the park have portable toilets and a makeshift kitchen, there is no place set up for washing. Antonim, organizer of the Occupy Toronto food team, declared efforts to feed people a success. "The city has supported us in a way I haven't seen before. Donations are coming in from the farmers' market, from bakeries, and from random individuals," he added. While there is no single issue at the center of the protest, Layla wanted to show her 2-year-old daughter what was happening. "I think it is important to show her there is resistance in Toronto. People believe we need more ethical societies in the world. I want her to see people can find joy in ways that don't involve hurting others," Layla said. Bet Walla was at the protest in support of education and was running a free library. "People can come and take a book and read it and then bring it back and get a new book. I just wanted to have a place for education. I am spreading awareness," he said. That by Kevin O'Connor for the QMI agency in the free daily newspaper 24 Hours. Let's take our second break in the show. Again, Canny Blues boss Wayne, "Way Overdue."
Is what I'm missing, and all the loving and hugging was so pleading to me, and all the dreaming of you that was oh so true is now overdue, overdue. I've been talking, I've been walking, I've been walking while I'm talking and reminiscing of things and we used to do, and all I'm thinking of you that is oh so true is now overdue, way overdue.
Wall Street protesters need to find their soundbite. On a drizzly evening in Zuccotti Park this week, where the Occupy Wall Street protesters are camped out, I spotted one young man wearing a T-shirt with an image of Ronald Reagan and the words, "Bad Religion." "What we now call the Reagan Revolution was a turning point in the American economy," said Jacob Hacker, a political science professor at Yale University in Connecticut. "These patterns of rising inequality were established then." Economists have been pointing out the growing gap for a decade, but particularly in the U.S., the increasingly skewed distribution didn't catch fire as a political issue. While the U.S. middle class is still in doldrums, the top 1% has largely recovered thanks in part to muscular intervention by the state. And that's why the taboo on talking about income distribution is lifting, particularly in Zuccotti Park. Class warfare has seldom had much traction in American politics because Americans tend to idealize the free market as a separate sphere of life with its own rough justice. Larry Bartels, a political science professor at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee and author of Unequal Democracy, wrote in an email reply, "Escalating inequality and the wreckage of the Great Recession may now be focusing increasing anger on that top sliver, especially bankers who are conveniently prominently implicated in the malfeasance that led to the financial meltdown of 2008 and still immensely rich." But the left shouldn't declare victory just yet. The middle-class anger is also being harnessed by the right and with greater and more focused political effect. Tea Party heroine Sarah Palin, in a speech in Seoul, Korea, railed against crony capitalism, complaining about well-connected banks get bailed out and certain companies get special deals through governments. The standard prescription of progressives, higher taxes, more regulation, a stronger social welfare net, more investment in education may be sensible, but it lacks the rallying power of Ms. Palin's call to smash crony capitalism by depriving the elites of their political tool, big government. Even the protesters in Zuccotti Park know their populist movement has found its complaint. We are the 99%, but not its remedy. After a lecture about income inequality delivered on the square by Sarah Burke, a policy analyst at a New York research organization, one listener said she was keen to educate people about the issue, but she wanted Ms. Burke's help with something. Quote, "What's my soundbite?" Unquote. The politician who answers that question will be the new Reagan of the left. That by Chrystia Freeland, editor, Thomson Reuters Digital, in the Globe and Mail. Protests buoyed by youth, anger, and social media, but still waiting for the middle class to pick sides. If there's a unifying theme to the protests that have leaped from continent to continent in recent days, with more to come, it's anger at the growing concentration of wealth among the top tier of income earners across the developed world. The emphasis of the protests differs somewhat according to the location. In Italy, where demonstrations turned violent on the weekend, the protesters complain about the rollback of education, welfare, and pension benefits that leave young people facing grimmer economic futures than their parents' generation. The same is true in much of Europe. In North America, the participants seem to be driven less by the specifics of their own economic insecurity, though that's one motivating factor, than the perceived injustice of recent bank bailouts, financial sector salaries, and capitalism's moral lapses. In a way, the Occupy Wall Street groups share their foundational principles with those of the American Tea Party movement, which targets most of the same culprits but articulates a right-wing populist prescription for change. Neither movement has made job creation its top demand. That, however, is what polls say middle-class voters consider most pressing. For the middle class, the real irritant is the sense that average folk can no longer reasonably aspire to get ahead. The dream of upward mobility, in essence the social contract at the heart of democratic capitalism, has been shattered. The evidence turns up in two-tier wage structures in the auto sector and other industries, in rollbacks in pension and health benefits, and among the jobless in a proportion of long-term unemployed in the United States that surpasses Depression-era heights. This is an explosive recipe for unrest. by raising oodles of money and mastering the existing political process to effect change, the Tea Party has sent a record number of small government Republicans to Congress and state legislatures. The Occupy Wall Street movement's fate depends on whether it can mount a prolonged and compelling enough opposition to the Tea Party to sway public opinion in its direction. The Tea Party calls for less regulation of Wall Street. The Occupy Wall Street seeks more. The Tea Party wants less income redistribution. Occupy Wall Street wants much more of it. It may be up to the middle class to decide which, if either, gets its way. That by Conrad Jakubowski from Washington for the Globe and Mail. The protesters' anger is real and banks should pay heed. The Occupy Wall Street protests are easily shrugged off as a ragtag band of activists with disparate aims, from ending corporate greed to canceling student debt to breaking up banks to just having a good time in the streets. And plenty of people are doing just that, shrugging off the growing protests as the work of freeloaders who want to take from the rich. The three-week-old protests have seen 700 people arrested for blocking the Brooklyn Bridge. Protesters have camped out in a New York park for days on end. The crowds are growing. An estimated 15,000 people marched in New York last week, and now the protests are spreading, with thousands gathering in Washington, D.C. Underlying the movement is a real concern about lost homes, lost jobs, and lost futures, argues Mr. Fink, head of BlackRock Incorporated, the world's largest asset management company. These are not lazy people who are just sitting around and trying to find something to do, Lawrence Fink told reporters in Toronto last week. These are men and women who say, I don't like the direction where we're going. I'm frightened of the future. Nothing else has worked, so we're going to the streets. The protests are a concern for Canadian banks. For some, they have to worry about the implications for their growing businesses in the United States. Toronto Dominion Bank has grown into one of the biggest banks in the eastern U.S., and Bank of Montreal recently bought a big Midwestern lender. In the U.S., people are really angry with banks, and they don't discriminate, said a senior Canadian bank official. This is how things start. We're definitely paying attention. While some of the anger fueling the protests in the U.S. is a natural outgrowth from a view that corrupt banks brought down the economy and ruined lives, Canada's banks have done no such things. But as Mr. Fink argues, there's something deeper beyond the sloganeering. For many, it's about a perception that the middle class can't get ahead because society is becoming more polarized. Bankers with their big pay packages and banks with their billion-dollar profits symbolize that. Whether or not the anger is misdirected, that's bad for business. We should all pause and say, what is the point here, Mr. Fink said. I'm not talking about the words or the posters. What is the implication? From my perspective, the implication is we have people losing hope and going into the streets. That by Boyd Erman in his column Streetwise in the Globe and Mail. Veterans Affairs to cut $226 million over 2 years. Veterans Affairs Canada plans to cut more than $226 million from its budget in the next 2 years, in what's expected to be the first wave of reductions in the department, according to federal documents. The department's Plans and Priorities report, which lays out spending up to 2014, shows compensation and financial support for ex-soldiers will see the biggest reduction. A spokeswoman for Veterans Affairs Minister Stephen Blaney says the individual benefits will continue without change or interruption, but the country will have fewer veterans overall. And that story from the Toronto Star. No byline. Coroner urges better care for ailing seniors. Star gets action. Nursing home deaths bring to light problems facing Ontario pensioners. Roughly 40,000 Ontario seniors live in some 700 retirement homes, which are privately operated and generally have less supports than long-term care nursing homes. The problem the Star has found is the lack of nursing home beds. If retirement home residents with high medical needs cannot find a spot in one of the province's 77,000 nursing home beds, they will have to pay for extra care. As of last year, there were 24,000 people on a waiting list for a nursing home bed. The Ontario government's new Retirement Homes Act will require the privately owned retirement homes to reassess residents' medical needs. Owners will also be required to tell residents of different care options, such as nursing homes, when their health declines. As well, said Dr. Dan Cass, the new Retirement Homes Regulatory Authority will investigate complaints about care. But seniors advocates warn that the complaint system is currently toothless because the government still hasn't passed the regulations that allow it to remove licenses from problem homes. Mary Beth Valentine, the registrar of the authority, said in an interview the advocates are correct. Much of the act is not yet in force. We have a limited role at the moment. The Star's undercover reporter detailed concerns from family and friends that two residents, 74-year-old Danny Henderson and 80-year-old Edith Farrell, died after suffering severe weight loss at retirement home In Touch. After it was published, the family of 83-year-old Nellie DiNano came forward with allegations their mother had medical problems that went untreated. When another resident, Clement Vachon, choked to death on his food in late December, Cass added his death to the investigation. In Touch owner Elaine Lindo told the Star she would not comment on the coroner's report. Judith Wall, executive director of the Advocacy Center for the Elderly, said relying on new legislation will not help the most vulnerable. Retirement homes, she said, are private rental accommodations that will charge medical fragile residents for each medical service that they need. That in the Toronto Star by Moira Welsh and Dale Brazeo, staff reporters. Darker skin, poorer health, says study. Black Canadians with darker skin are more likely to report poor health than lighter-skinned Black Canadians, suggests a new study that blames the problem on colorism. The University of British Columbia study surveyed 1,500 people from Vancouver and Toronto about their racial identities and health. Black Canadians were more likely to report high blood pressure, and Asian Canadians were more likely to report poor mental health, both findings in keeping with previous research. But the study also found that Black Canadians with darker skin were more than four times as likely to report poor overall health than lighter-skinned Black Canadians. Jerry Veenstra, a UBC sociology professor and lead author of the study, said the reasons are complex and entirely social. He explained darker-skinned African Americans tend to make less money, have lower levels of education, marry low-income partners, and live in low-income neighborhoods. These socioeconomic conditions in turn affect things like stress levels, access to healthy food, and medicine and lifestyle choices. Veenstra hopes to continue his research by looking at larger sample groups, conducting in-person interviews, and focusing more on how colorism affects Asian Canadians. The study is published in the journal Social Science and Medicine. And that by Reuters in the Daily Free newspaper, 24 Hours. Peel police apologize, but the force does not admit to racially profiling Brampton man. Peel police have apologized to a 60-year-old Brampton man who accused the force of racial profiling after he was locked in a cruiser and interrogated by officers. Isaac Williams, who emigrated from Jamaica in 1972, was detained and questioned on August 12th while police searched for a break-and-enter suspect 6 inches shorter than Williams and one-third his age. I'm truly sorry that our interaction left you feeling as though you have been treated with anything less than the respect that you deserve, Constable Samantha Emery told Williams in a written apology. She also apologized to Williams in person on Tuesday evening at a meeting facilitated by the police to resolve the complaint. Williams said police officials told him Emery, a rookie who joined the force in January, and the other officers involved in his detention will also undergo retraining. The force did not apologize or admit to racially profiling Williams, the heart of his complaint. Williams was on one of his prescribed daily walks on Dixie Road near Balmoral Drive a few minutes from his Lincoln Court home when he says he was confronted and aggressively questioned by Emery. "She was shouting at me, 'Where are you going? Where were you coming from?'" he told the Star in August. At Tuesday's meeting, Williams said the detectives who investigated his complaint told him that Emery detained him because his clothing matched those of the suspect. But Emery did not listen to the suspect's full description on her police radio, notably his much younger age. That by Brendan Kennedy in the Toronto Star. Scott Haldane is the chairman of the National Panel on First Nations Elementary and Secondary Education, the federally appointed panel touring the country for the latest in a long list of reports and studies to examine the abysmal rates of high school graduation and post-secondary achievement for Canada's Aboriginal peoples. "I think most Canadians have no idea," Haldane said after the panel wrapped up meetings with students, teachers, parents, and Aboriginal officials in British Columbia. The panel will be in Manitoba and Alberta later this month before stops in Saskatchewan and Quebec next month. They have already held meetings in Ontario, BC, and the Atlantic provinces. Haldane admits he's found some of the conditions shocking as he has explored on-reserve education across the country. "We have one educational system run by provinces, and then we have a non-system with some exceptions. You couldn't really call this a system, said Haldane, the CEO of YMCA Canada, who was appointed this summer to head up the national panel, a joint initiative of the federal government and the Assembly of First Nations. Deborah Jeffrey, the head of BC's First Nations Education Steering Committee, is all too aware that many reports have come before and little has changed for students at any of the 520 schools operated by bands on the First Nations reservations across Canada. There are also 7 federal schools still operating on Canadian reserves, 6 in Ontario and 1 in Alberta. And that story by Dean Moore, from the Canadian Press in the Hamilton Spectator. And on a lighter note, a woman beaten with a cane. Hamilton police have arrested a woman they say is a cane-wielding phone bandit. A 50-year-old woman was arrested after a 21-year-old woman called police just after 1 p.m. a week ago Tuesday to say she'd been robbed of her cell phone. The younger woman had been waiting for a bus at the corner of Mohawk Road West and Upper Paradise Road. After boarding a bus, she realized she'd left her phone on a bench at the bus stop. After getting the driver to stop, the woman ran back to the bus stop and saw another woman pick up the phone. The phone's owner asked the woman for her phone and described it to prove ownership. The suspect refused to give it up and began beating the owner with her cane and then walked away. Police located the suspect in the area. A 50-year-old Hamilton woman has been charged with robbery with a weapon. She was released on a promise to appear in Hamilton Court November 7th. And that's all the news we have this week, with disrespect, but come back next week. There will be more. To take us out, Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, Rockin' Boogie Party.
Party. Yeah, I don't rock and boogie party. Yeah, I don't rock. not even a star, not even a friend in a rock and boogie party. Yeah, at a rock and boogie party.
This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.